Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan, and our discussion today is on the famous, or perhaps infamous, case of Dred Scott v. Sanford in 1857, one of the most important Supreme Court decisions, and along with, say, Plessy v. Ferguson of 1896, perhaps one of the most condemned Supreme Court decisions in American history, although at the time it was regarded by one section of the United States as a fairly good decision. That would be the South. And the reason it was so controversial at the time, at least in the North, is because the Supreme Court was hoping to end the issue of slavery in the territories, whether it should be legal or not. And by rendering this decision, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, and writing the majority opinion, Roger Taney, hoped to strike it from the political scene forever. But what it's going to do is actually cause more problems than it solves. And it's often a misunderstood case, and there are several points of that that I need to go through. The long-term effects of this particular decision in terms of how the Supreme Court will view its powers are also long-lasting. When you look at, say, for example, substantive due process against procedural due process, and this particular case is often cited as one of the first instances of substantive due process in American history. So we need to analyze at least that particular component of this case. This, again, has a lot to do with the 1850s, and if you want to find out more about what I thought about the 1850s, you can go look at the first half of our U.S. History Survey course and see and get an idea for everything I think about, you know, the 1850s and all the political turmoil and other issues going on there. So this is just one segment of that particular time period, and what one historian has called the blundering generation period, because you have this particular case, you have the 1860 election, you have the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, and on down the line. It just seemed like everything was falling apart in the 1850s because the people who were in charge of things, people who had power, were not doing a very good job of keeping the Union together. So this case, again, is a major component of that. So let's look at the case in more detail. Starting off with Dred Scott. So who is Dred Scott? Well, Dred Scott was actually a slave in Missouri, and at one point he's going to be taken into a free state of Wisconsin. And at that point, when he's brought back, he actually sues for his freedom. And the case, so he'll actually get a hearing in Missouri and win on one level and then loses on another level as the case is appealed up the line. And eventually it winds up in the United States Supreme Court. So the major issue at hand, of course, is whether Dred Scott can even be suing in federal court. Now, this case, of course, involved the major sectional issues of the 1840s and 1850s. And what do I mean by that? Well, throughout the 1840s, particularly beginning in 1848, you had a dedicated group of people in the North who were insistent on keeping slavery out of the Western territories. And this started with the Mexican Cession. When the United States wins the war with Mexico, we acquire a large chunk of territory, including the present states of California and Nevada and Utah and New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado. So it's a large chunk of territory. And because of that, and because it was very obvious this was the major goal of that particular war, you know, James K. Polk wanted California, a congressman named David Wilmot attaches a rider to a military spending bill called the Wilmot Proviso. And that would have outlawed slavery in any territory acquired during the war. So in response, we have this political solution over and over again. We get the Compromise of 1850, which was which involved the doctrine of popular sovereignty to deal with slavery in the territories. Essentially, the people of the territories could decide whether it be free or slave. Now, we already had the famous Missouri Compromise, which I talked about in one of our earlier presentations, which said that slavery was not allowed in the Louisiana Purchase north of the southern border of Missouri, with the exclusion, of course, of Missouri itself. So that had long been an issue that people thought was settled. So perhaps this popular sovereignty issue would settle the problem here in 1850 with the Compromise of 1850. That was the hope, and you had people like Henry Clay and Daniel Webster and John C. Calhoun arguing for and against the compromise, and eventually it does pass and is signed by President Millard Fillmore. Now, fast forward 4 years to 1854, and we get the organization of the Kansas and Nebraska Territory, and Stephen Douglas, a senator from Illinois, is trying to hope to make some money, and also he has presidential aspirations, so he's going to hope that this thing will get him some southern votes, because what he wants to do is organize Kansas and Nebraska under popular sovereignty as well. And there's a problem with that because Kansas and Nebraska are in this old Louisiana Purchase territory. So that territory was supposed to be not open to slavery at all. It was prohibited in that territory. So eventually he's going to get his way. The Kansas-Nebraska Act will pass, so Kansas and Nebraska will be organized under popular sovereignty, which brings us to all the major issues happening after that point. You know, the famous episode of Bleeding Kansas and the violence there, supposed violence, so, you know, slavery versus pro-slavery forces, anti-slavery versus pro-slavery forces in Kansas. So when the 1856 election rolls around, we actually have a new presidential candidate and a new political party. The Democrat Party, which was a national party, was still around. And, of course, in 1856, they nominate a man named James Buchanan. Buchanan was an old, very powerful Democrat from Pennsylvania. He had a lot of support, North and South. In fact, Northerners who didn't agree with him often called him a doughface, a guy who would woo Southerners to try to get votes. And the northern sectional candidate is going to be John Charles Fremont, and he's a candidate for the Republican Party. Now, the Republican Party was only formed in 1854, so here you are 2 years later. It was formed actually in response to this Kansas-Nebraska bill, essentially. And here we are 2 years later. They already have a major political candidate, a presidential candidate. And Fremont was an ambitious guy. During the war with Mexico, he was governor of California and perhaps at one time thought about being the president of the Republic of California, because for a very short period of time, he had the Bear Flag Republic. So Fremont had presidential ambitions, or at least greater ambitions than being a military officer from the beginning. So this would suit him just fine to become president of the United States. Well, Fremont, it's a fairly close election. I mean, closer than the Democrats thought it should be. The Republicans had picked up many seats in the House of Representatives. The Democrats were almost becoming a sectional party themselves, with a lot of support in the South and dwindling support in the North. A lot of Northern Democrats had jumped ship and joined the Republican Party, or the American Party, which was a know-nothing party, an anti-immigration party. So, you know, generally what we're having here is a reorganization of the political parties. So Buchanan sees this as a real problem. The Republicans, one of their main planks, of course, in 1856, their campaign slogan was free soil, free speech, free men, Fremont, and victory, right? So this is a sectional anti-slavery party, at least in theory. And when I say anti-slavery, they wanted to prohibit slaves from entering the Western territories. So Buchanan could see the writing on the wall, and so could many other Democrats, that if this was going to continue, the Democrats might be relegated to a minority status, because it's obvious, you know, Fremont's going to get a lot of votes in the North, the Democrats could splinter, and we could have all kinds of political problems, which is exactly what will happen in 1860. So as a result, James Buchanan is going to concoct this plan to try to get the Supreme Court to deal with the slavery question once and for all. And the Supreme Court Chief Justice at the time was a man named Roger Taney. Now, Roger Taney is an interesting figure. He was also the Secretary of the Treasury at one point under Andrew Jackson. It's Roger Taney who was responsible for withdrawing all the United States deposits out of the Bank of the Second Bank of the United States and putting them in the various state banks, which people disparagingly called Andrew Jackson's pet banks. So Taney had no problem with perhaps, you know, breaking the law and violating the Constitution as Secretary of the Treasury. In fact, that's why he stayed on. Jackson was hiring and firing people at will because of the fact that, you know, these people wouldn't do what he asked. So Taney finally does it. And later he's appointed, of course, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Now, Taney's from Maryland, so he's from the southern state, but he's also an abolitionist. So he's not a person who's in tune with the South, at least in that particular way. He doesn't think slavery is a good thing, thinks it's a moral evil. But at the same time, he's also an adherent to what he thinks is the Constitution as ratified, you know, the Founder's Constitution, which would leave the issue of slavery to the states alone. And when James Buchanan is being sworn in, and then, of course, gives his inaugural address in 1857, Taney supposedly whispers in Buchanan's ear at one point, and Buchanan will say, well, yes, the slavery issue will be addressed in the very near future. Because so what you have here is perhaps interference from the executive branch in the judicial process. So slavery regulation in the territory has been going back, you know, before the Missouri Compromise. We had the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, and, you know, the Congress was allowed to legislate for slavery there. So this has always been a fairly contentious issue. And the idea was to have, again, a constitutional remedy. How are we going to solve this problem through the Supreme Court make it to where no one will then can raise an issue against it? So if the Supreme Court can rule on this, and say, you know, slavery is one way or the other, allowed or not allowed in the territories, then perhaps the issue will be a dead letter in the future, and perhaps maybe crush and kill the Republican Party. That was the objective, to kill the Republican Party and go back to the old system where you had a national party like the Whigs and a national party like the Democrats and take the slavery issue off the table. So the major issues involved are pretty simple. First and foremost, could Dred Scott sue in court? Tawney's going to rule on that very quickly. But that was a question because, of course, Dred Scott is a slave, and slaves are not citizens of the United States. Therefore, can a non-citizen sue in federal court? And if so, can't all slaves sue in federal courts? This is a major issue to address. It's a problem. I also must note that after the decision was made, Dred Scott would eventually be freed. He's suing for his freedom at this point. The other question is, of course, could the federal government restrict slavery in the territories? Did it have the authority to do so in the Missouri Compromise, in the Compromise of 1850, in the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854? Did it have the authority to go out there and say, we're not going to allow slavery in these territories? Could it even do that to begin with? The other question, of course, is what role did the Supreme Court have in this process? And so Tawney's going to say, well, it has a large role because it is the final arbiter in these decisions. And so as the Congress would pass legislation, the Supreme Court could declare it constitutional or not. Now, that had only been done one time before, but of course, Tawney thinks that it could happen again. And finally, would this settle a major political and constitutional issue of the antebellum period? Would it? This is the major question. So Southerners thought it did, Northerners thought it didn't. And the reaction to it is almost instantaneously a positive in one area and, terrible in the other area. The North condemns it, the South supports it. So this thing is going to do a lot to ultimately lead to the destruction of the Union just a few years later because it galvanizes the sides. The South would say, well, here it is. The Supreme Court has finally made its decision. The North would say, well, who cares? And I'll talk about that and perhaps the issue of nullification here in one second. So the decision, this is politically motivated even, in the first time since 1803 that the Supreme Court had declared a federal law unconstitutional. Now, they'd done that with states several times, but the federal government, federal law had been off the books now and off the limits for over 50 years. Didn't mean they couldn't do it, they just hadn't done it. So it's the first time in 54 years that the Supreme Court has declared a federal law unconstitutional. So here we have, the South supporting a position that they had been vehemently against all the way back in 1803, and the North against the position that they had been very much for in 1803. So this is a political decision. Everyone knows the court is political. We don't have any thought about that today that, we think the court is impartial and non-political. It's very open and blatant for everyone to see that the court is pretty political, and your political leanings have an effect on how you're going to judge in a particular case. But that wasn't necessarily the situation here in the 1850s. A lot of people still believed in an impartial Supreme Court. So, Tawney's going to write the majority opinion, which was not unanimous. There was dissent, and the dissent actually had a fairly good field day with this. But Tawney's decision says that Scott is not a citizen and therefore cannot sue in federal court. Simple enough. If that's where the decision had stopped, no one would have said anything about this. It's just like Marbury v. Madison. If John Marshall had stopped when he said, I basically have no jurisdiction in this matter, the Marbury v. Madison decision would have been a footnote at the most in American history. Same thing with Dred Scott. If Tawney had stopped here and said, well, slaves can't sue in federal court, then that's it. There's no issue to be addressed. But he goes further. So instead of saying, you can't sue in federal court, we have no jurisdiction here, the decision of Missouri stands in the issue, he goes further. And essentially what he said was that slavery restriction in the territory was unconstitutional. So that meant that the Missouri Compromise of 1820, the Compromise of 1850, the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 were all unconstitutional pieces of legislation. So now what he has done, theoretically, is open up the entire Western Territory to slavery. Now, he didn't open up the North to slavery because the states can still prohibit slavery themselves, but he's opened up all the territory. And so this is going back to the argument that Southerners made in the late 1840s when it came to the war with Mexico. They said, we've bled and died for this territory. This is the common property of the United States. We should have common access to the property of the United States. And if you say we can't bring our slaves, then you're actually working against Southerners. You're only opening up the territory to Northerners who don't have slaves. If we want to take our slaves west, which are our property, we should be able to do so. And Taney's defense was that the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution protected slave property in the territories. So he said, according to the Fifth Amendment, it says that you're entitled to your life, liberty, or property as long as you have due process. So this gets into the issue of substantive due process against procedural due process. Substantive due process, Dr. Gusman has a long presentation about it. But substantive due process is basically the case where the Supreme Court is going to be very active, and they often call this legislating from the bench. They're going to block legislative action to secure a particular right. So it's a court negative on legislation. So they're going to say you can't even consider passing legislation in this particular way. So what people have said, the idea behind this decision was to say that the Congress could pass no more legislation dealing with slavery. It was to protect Southern property by prohibiting Congress from doing anything about it. Now, procedural due process would be, you know, let's say you're deprived of your property, but as long as you've had the proper procedures in that way, you know, whether it was in a hearing in a court of law or whether it was through a legislative process where the majority would decide one way or the other, that would be fine. And in fact, so you have, did the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, was it a substantive due process amendment or a procedural due process amendment? And, you know, people that are against substantive due process often say, well, what we should do is have constitutional amendments or legislation that would protect the rights of property. But we shouldn't have the Supreme Court legislating from the bench in this particular way because that causes all kinds of problems for the future. So, this is often cited as the first time, and I'll say this in the next slide, the first time that substantive due process, has been used by the federal court system. There's an argument that there was another case in 1852. That did the exact same thing, but this is a major decision that's going to have more impact than just as a Supreme Court decision. So Buchanan and Taney hoped that this would settle the issue, as did many opponents of the Republican Party. They thought once the Supreme Court ruled on the issue, once the Supreme Court made a decision, well, that's it. There's no going back on this, and it was universally, you know, accepted in the South. In fact, what's really interesting is I wrote my dissertation on a senator from Delaware named James A. Byard, and his son wrote to him after the decision was made that this settles it once and for all. Because now the South can say that you can't pass any legislation prohibiting slavery in the territories. James A. Byard responded back saying, well, not so fast. There are still going to be people that will oppose it. And in fact, it happened very quickly. This gets down to the issue of nullification. There were several northern states that actually started using their personal liberty laws a little more effectively at this point. They had long been doing it, you know, since actually the 1840s. But they're going to ensure that runaway slaves or slaves that get into their states are not going to be allowed to be recaptured. So they're actually nullifying the Fugitive Slave Act. So this, in this case, nullification is used against slavery and against, theoretically, the Taney decision. And several Northern Democrats, most importantly, Stephen A. Douglas, rejected it. Stephen A. Douglas, of course, ran against Abraham Lincoln for the Senate in 1858, or at least Lincoln ran against Douglas. And they have the very famous Lincoln-Douglas debates, which get a lot of publicity and a lot of, you know, a lot of people pay attention to these things. For the life of me, sometimes I can't figure out why. But Stephen A. Douglas came out with something called the Freeport Doctrine at this point. And essentially what he said is that I don't care what the Supreme Court says. Popular sovereignty is the law of the land, and that's what we're going to use in the territories. So, Douglas is going against the Dred Scott decision. Republicans would also gain strength from the decision. They would gain seats because of the Dred Scott decision. So more Northerners are going to galvanize in their opposition to the South and what they start calling the slave power here in the late 1850s. So rather than have a positive effect for the Union, this has a negative effect on the Union. Taney and Buchanan have now just put another nail in the coffin of the Union. The Union of the Founders, by coming up with this weird concocted way to handle the question of the territories. It also had, you know, dubious constitutional reasoning, and it was a poor political solution. So if Scott's not a citizen, then he shouldn't be able to sue in court. If the Missouri Compromise is unconstitutional, we'll let the Congress decide that. I mean, here we are, you know, 37 years after the Missouri Compromise has been passed by the founding generation. Generally, there were a number of people from the founding generation in that particular group of people who passed the Missouri Compromise. Then, you know, we have real problems here. And the Dred Scott case is going to cause more trouble than it's worth. Now, this is, again, also the first instance of substantive due process, which is often called legislating from the bench. So the Taney court is going to legislate from the bench in this particular case by saying that the Congress cannot pass any laws doing this, you know, prohibiting slavery in the territories. And we oftentimes originalists are very much against this stuff. Now, the one argument I can see, you know, people say, well, this really isn't substantive due process. Of course, you know, Taney was using it in that way. And there is this, I think the argument the South had was a fairly interesting argument. And if it is the common property of the United States, then everyone should have access to it. You can't prohibit certain people from going in that property. I mean, you can take this, for example, today. Let's say the United States had some common property. They said a certain group of people can't go in that territory, even though you're a citizen of the United States. That would be, you know, seen as an affront to those groups of people, discrimination, basically. And so this is what the South is saying. You're discriminating against us because we have slaves. And we bled and died for that territory just like Northerners did or non-slaveholders did, so we should be able to have access to it as well. And again, this is going to tarnish the image, a reputation, I should say, of an impartial Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's not impartial, and everyone knew it before this point, but now it's really exposed for all it is. You know, the emperor has no clothes now. From this point forward, you're going to get very politicized of courts. Whether it's if they're opponents of strong central authority or proponents of strong central authority, that's what you're going to get in this particular period of time. So the Dred Scott v. Sanford case is extremely detrimental to the future of the Union.